This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, Morgan Reynolds, who is a former chief economist in the Department of Labor in the George W. Bush administration and a professor of economics and the general man about town who's very knowledgeable about many subjects, including 9/11, where he's been pounding his head against the wall, as have the rest of us, for quite a few years now. Morgan, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to The Real Deal.
Well, thank you for having me on the show once again, Jim.
Yeah, it's really nice to have the chance to talk again. It's been a while. And I thought one good reason would be to get your take on the current state of research on 9/11 and where you think this is all headed.
Well, my feeling is that we've plateaued in recent months. To my knowledge, there aren't any real breakthroughs. I've got a minor one I'm about to put up on my website, nomoregames.net, but I didn't make it for this show. But at any rate, our progress has been pretty modest lately, I'd say. And personally, I've been at this 5 years, more or less full-time. And now, especially given the state of the world political economy and the national economy, I've been working more a little bit in that direction. It's exciting times, that's for sure. So it's really, we're coming up on the 8th anniversary, and it's, well, you got to wonder, I do, whether we're ever going to break this wide open, the whole fraud, and get a real prosecution is what I would like, rather than any kind of government-sponsored investigation. We independent researchers are doing the investigation, and we've made a tremendous amount of headway. And certainly we've proven the government media story wrong in every respect. Proven it.
Yes.
And one of the venues, of course, I was involved in was the legal strategy of trying to get NIST to change its lies. Of course, NIST did the study on the destruction of, well, not the destruction of the Twin Towers, but up to the point of collapse, as they carefully put it. So I tried the informal route there where it got no satisfaction, although I got NIST to admit that you wouldn't expect an aircraft to decelerate immediately in a collision, which is absurd, but we will talk about that those spoilers later. But and then I, with the help of attorney Jerry Liebhardt, filed basically a no-plane suit against the NIST contractors, and of course we had the legal wherewithals lined up. And then there was a related suit, you could call it, by Dr. Judy Wood and his name escapes me now, Ed Blank down there in South Carolina, regarding the WTC-7 investigation. Well, the judge wrote a very, what shall I say, ill-tempered and unresponsive denial, okay? They granted the request for the dismissal of these suits. So we never got to get anybody under oath, which is what I wanted to do. And with knowledgeable cross-examination by Jerry Liebhardt and yours truly in a court of law, the standards of evidence, et cetera, would have been great. That would have been a vehicle to blow this wide open. Now, Dr. Wood's suit, which is basically a, it was basically the molecular dissociation challenge to the NIST work, which is a cover-up. Of course, NIST, being a political agency, they have the result first, and then they're going to use the trappings, the appearance of scientific investigation to support the predetermined political result, namely aircraft crashes into each tower, ultimately brought them down with excessive heat, you know, which is a completely false diagnosis. Well, her suit is on appeal at the appellate level in a federal court there in New York State. And once again, it seems like they're dragging their feet. But I like this regardless of the outcome. Well, one of the advantages of, and it didn't make any sense for me to go through with a similar expensive procedure when we need only hold their feet to the fire on one of the suits. And what is very nice is regardless of the decision about Dr. Wood's well-documented scientific findings regarding the events at the World Trade Center in the morning of September 11, 2001, there is, in standard practice, an oral hearing. And the justices, the three appellate judges, are often at least, if not better informed than the attorneys in the case. So there's a tradition of excellence there. And in addition, even should they rebuff the appeal by Dr. Wood, they'd have to lay out why. Whereas this district court judge, and I've got a refutation on my website, nomoregames.net, if you listeners would care to look it up, I answer the judge line by line, paragraph by paragraph. So, you know, you can't expect, because of the political dynamite here, the explosive nature of this, you can't expect a pro-truth outcome. But we can make them prove up that they're going to lie their way out no matter what. That's maybe a harsh way to put it, but anyway, that's one venue that we had to try.
Oh, yes, I have nothing
if
but
you, listeners who care to look it up. I answer the judge line by line, paragraph by paragraph. So, you know, you can't expect, because of the political dynamite here, the explosive nature of this, you can't expect a pro-truth outcome. But we can make them prove up that they're going to lie their way out no matter what. That's maybe a harsh way to put it, but anyway, that's one venue that we had to try.
Oh, yes, I have nothing but admiration for you and Judy and Jerry Leapart for undertaking this exercise, Morgan, which seems to me to have put their feet to the coals. And whether they're able to squirm out of it or not, it's a very important avenue of approach.
And, yeah, and we'll have them on record. And if only history judges them harshly, well, that is at least one desirable outcome, the famous long run.
Well, let me see if I can nudge you a token in the direction that maybe things aren't actually quite tapering off. If you go to PatriotsQuestion911.com now, you'll see that in the last 6 months or so, some 400 new persons, you know, experts in different fields, have been added to the list. And just to mention over a dozen recent persons who have added up, we have Jeanette Fitzsimmons, who's a member of Parliament in New Zealand, added March 6, 2009. Ole Gerstrom, a former member of Parliament of Denmark, added March 6, 2009. Senator Mohammed Ibrahim Khan, member of the Senate of Pakistan, added March 7th. Johann Weisbuch, MD, MPH, a former chief medical officer of the states of Wyoming and North Dakota, added March 7th. Robin Cook, former Secretary of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs, United Kingdom, added March 12th. Douglas N. Everingham, MBBS, former Member of Parliament and former Minister of Health, Australia, added March 12th. Senator Bob Kerry, member of the 9/11 Commission, former U.S. Senator from Nebraska, added March 18th.
And he signed up. What does it mean?
We'll talk about some of these, Morgan.
That's ridiculous.
Angelo M. Codavilla, Ph.D., former Foreign Service Officer, U.S. State Department, added March 28th. Egon Frid, Member of Parliament, Sweden, added March 31st, 2009. Bill Goodacre, former member of the Legislature of British Columbia, Canada, added April 1st, 2009. And Annie Michon, former M15 intelligence officer, added April 17th. Senator Charles Schirmer, U.S. Senator from New York, added April 19, 2009. Vice President Walter Mondale, 42nd Vice President of the United States, added April 23, 2009. Harry Sammet, Special Agent FBI, added May 5, 2009. In general, Morgan, while we might wonder, you know, about Kerry, who seems to be on both sides of the fence, I think this is relatively encouraging that we're getting persons of the prominence of members of Parliament, for United States senators, even a former vice president signing on.
Yeah, true. I mean, it's hard to argue against this, but it's far short of the breaking it wide open type. You know, it's maybe incremental, very modest. I'm a little suspicious about how this will get us there. You know, I guess the idea is it'll make it more comfortable for more people to look at this, to open this dark closet door.
Yeah.
And the more people become informed that it is a fraud, that the government corporate media story is unsustainable, the better. True. But I'm not really inspired.
Well, let me ask you about another development which may elicit the same response. I have a good friend who is also a friend of Kevin Barrett, who is a, you know, kind of a web addict. So he goes to many of these forums, including the JREF forum, and he likes to be provocative. And lately he's been touting them with this article with about 7 or 8 co-authors about the discovery of thermitic material in the dust from the Twin Towers that was published by one of the Bentham Science publications. And I just wondered what you make of that. Of course, this is the fruition of Steve Jones' efforts over these last several years, and I know neither you nor I believe that thermite can possibly provide an adequate explanation for what happened, but it certainly could have made a contribution, and I just wonder, you know, how you take this development.
Well, it makes me suspicious that there's something there distracting attention from. So maybe Dr. Wood's going to come out with a new path-breaking revelation, but as you well know, hair work is the word definitive comes to mind. I mean, the very exhaustive assembly of evidence. She's followed what is the standard criminal investigation procedure, and that is you find out what happened first. Whereas Dr. Jones and his group started off with this very specific type of welding material called thermite, and then supposedly, you know, super duper thermite and thermate and whatnot has these explosive properties. So, you know, nano super tech thermite. Well, I think all of this is simply a one of many out there, but maybe the most important one is a cul-de-sac. It's a siding and a rail. It's a rail spur that doesn't go anywhere. So it's kind of interesting that they gin this up again, and it's almost like a whatever Stephen Jones does. I don't think this is too strong. It really points toward what happened in a 180-degree fashion. That is, if they're trying to cover up something like the presence of magnetism or electromagnetic field effects, then I'd say, well, wait a minute, there's probably something here. And then, you know, I was thinking about this earlier today, Jim, how Stephen Jones, he comes across as a cuddly teddy bear, a great uncle guy, honest and has a giggle and supposedly is competent as a scientist. But I can remember when he first appeared on the scene, Gerard Holmgren, the now inactive 9/11 researcher in Australia, caught him up in a lie right away because Jones insisted that he had gone out and inspected a Boeing 757 aircraft on the undercarriage and whatnot, identical to one that would have struck the World Trade Center tower. And this thorough investigation of course, was undermined rather quickly when Gerard Holmgren pointed out, no, it was a 767 that the government says struck each of the Twin Towers. So right away, I thought, wow, this is really sloppy. This is really careless, 757. And we were all giving Jones the benefit of the doubt early on because, of course, we wanted a credentialed physicist to weigh in and contribute on the research front as well as the political educative role. So this latest little flare-up, I listened to some of this coast-to-coast interview on with George Norrie involved and this woman reporter.
Tell me about it because I missed it, Morgan. Tell me about it.
Well,
who was on?
There were like four. First of all, they had I don't have all the specifics, but I can give you what I can recall. And they had a physicist, a biochemist from Copenhagen, whose name escapes me, a Danish scholar.
Yeah, he was one of the
authors, yeah. And on about these red-gray chips and all the evidence for this. It's not paint and so on, highly reactive, supposedly, although why they've got this material that didn't react, if it was so reactive, wasn't answered. It didn't even come up. You know, this reporter was more of a propagandist, I would say. It didn't ask any telling questions at all. So that was one. It seemed like they played recordings from Dr. Stephen E. Jones rather than doing direct interviews. But she was interviewed by George Norrie, and it was more or less, wow, you know, this is really the real deal, or why don't we have an investigation? But there's just no way, that, in my opinion, my, I guess you could say, inexpert opinion, that this was a display of the power of thermite on 9/11. It was a display of what we can call directed energy or free energy. I mean, they did an impressive thing there, didn't they? They turned two massive towers to powder, fine powder virtually, you know, most of the material. I mean, there wasn't a commode, a computer, on and on. There wasn't any of the standard material you'd find from a so-called collapse or any kind of conventional destructive material like thermite. So, you know, it was 10 seconds, you know, more or less for these two massive. It was quite a display, but it wasn't anything like this kind of pop gun material.
You didn't stick through the entire interview, I take it.
No, I did four segments. I think they were like 10 minutes.
Uh huh.
I didn't hear it live. I was. We were listening to the MP3.
They archive all those coast-to-coast shows, so it would be pretty easy to track it down.
Yes, it would, yeah.
Have you heard Sophia offering the suggestion of the possibility that maybe a fluorine gas could have been used, that fluorine is very interactive with steel and has the capacity to dissolve it?
Oh, my. Yeah, well, I've heard it, but I didn't. To me, it wasn't worth my time to investigate. I'm sure I'll hear more of it. Maybe you know more of it.
Well, I'm just intrigued by it because, you know, something that would account for everything. I really hope you'll bring me up to date on Judy, her latest views, because I've tried to, you know, induce her to come on the show again, but she's non-responsive, so I haven't had the chance. What is the latest? I know she has these views about Hurricane Aaron that I've never quite sorted out, so I think the audience would be glad to hear anything you can tell us about it.
Well, maybe I should serve as a guest host someday and interview her. But if you go to her website, which I'm going to do right now.
DrJudyWood.com.
DrJudyWood.com, or I actually still have it as DrJudyWood.com. co.uk. That's maybe I should get that changed. But the title of that work is 9/11 Weather Anomalies and Field Effects.
Uh-huh.
So the Hurricane Aaron there's a couple of weird things about it. It looks weird in terms of the eye of the hurricane. So that at least suggests maybe it's artificial or man-created weather. And the thing, it went for hundreds of miles on a straight line toward New York City. And then, and don't hold me to this strictly, but within hours before the events of 9/11, maybe it's 12 hours or maybe it's half a day or day, but it took a sharp right turn. And it was a threat to the island of Manhattan and the New York City area for, and then it was downgraded to a one or something low, but it was a massive spread to this thing.
And it wasn't being reported by the meteorologists.
There's a couple of suspicious things I've already mentioned, and then maybe most important to me as a political observer is the silencio from the corporate media. And government, it should have been warning people, okay?
Warning people that coming up to 9/11 that there's a huge hurricane, that there might be a problem here.
Right. And, we all have this impression it was this balmy day, which by and large it was on the East Coast, okay? Yeah, I was in Washington, D.C. that morning, and it was one of these unlimited vision type mornings, mid-morning. And yet here is this hurricane off the coast of New York, and it has an enormous breadth, even though it had been downgraded. I believe it might have been a 3 originally or a 2, kind of a mid. Energy in this thing was still very significant, and a tidal wave. So at any rate, it was a threat, and they kept quiet. So that. It's just an incredible, that observation to me is an indictment of the media. It's not a conviction. Dr. Wood believes you are, I'm speaking for her, but I think this is accurate, have muddled it up. It's not, she didn't ever say, I don't believe that, or write that there was, that this was the energy source for the directed energy. But it is. Now, she believes that conventional weather analysis is inept or erroneous in some respects. And so this was a field, an electromagnetic field. It's got a lot of energy. That doesn't mean it's the energy source for directed energy weapons.
Well, that was my conjecture, Morgan, when I first heard that a hurricane had been off the coast, that it would represent a tremendous amount of potential energy.
Yeah, that's your conjecture. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was never anything more than a conjecture because I couldn't get Judy to come on the show to tell me if I was right or wrong in my guess.
Well, this is similar to the allegation that she and I believe that there were space beams, satellite launch destruction of the Twin Towers and the WTC more generally. Well, now wait a minute, that's possible, but we don't say that, we don't say what the platform was. And certainly I believe that there's sufficient evidence to make virtually everybody suspect, if not believe, that there's weaponization in space.
Well, it was my first big interview with Judy, the one that became so controversial, where I had gone through her website, and I was so impressed with everything she'd done. And I asked her, I was out in Tucson, and we were doing the show, and I was asking her where she thought the source could be located. And when she eventually said space, I was just kind of blown away, because there's another alternative, and she actually meant on a satellite, and I thought that was fascinating as an alternative, because these sources can be land-based, air-based, dirigible. They could be on planes, or they could be on satellites. It would be, about 2 years later before Bob Bowman, who had been the scientific director of the Star Wars program under, I think, Carter and Ford, would acknowledge that the Star Wars program had always been offensive, that it had never been defensive. When I was pressing him about the militarization of space, he was even unwilling to tell me that that was what was going on, but later, within a couple of months, he conceded that that indeed was what was going on, which I thought lent great plausibility to the possibility that it could be space-based. But it was the case that she was offering that hypothesis. You know, I'm not saying that she was definitive about it, but that it was a possibility that emerged then and became a source of considerable controversy.
Well, you know, there's a couple things that is going on here where the first thing is that the perps were so audacious in this whole scheme that it makes it easier to cover up, and the cover-up's more important than the execution of the crime and any errors during it, you know. So it makes it really hard for the rest of us who want truth and justice in this whole event to get it, because it's just they did such a, I could say, extraordinary job by using unfamiliar weaponry, for example.
Yeah, that's part of the genius of it. They did the same thing in taking down the plane that killed Senator Paul Wellstone and his wife.
Yeah, okay, right.
Morgan, let's take a few minutes break here, and then we'll continue our conversation. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest, Morgan Reynolds. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, and we've been talking about a variety of issues related to 9/11 and most recently about the Hurricane Erin off the coast of New York, where I'd offered the conjecture that perhaps this was the source of energy for the weapons that could have been used to dismantle the towers by turning them into very fine dust from top to bottom. And Morgan, you know, if I had that wrong, and it was merely a speculation on my part because Judy wasn't coming on the show, and even though I invited her repeatedly, I wish she'd just drop me an email to say that that was not the point, that the point was something to do with the failure of the weathermen and meteorologists to explain that it was there.
Well, remember now that she has been against these calculations. As, I'm thinking of the related one, you know, well, how many units of energy would it take, you know, to turn these... collapse these buildings or turn them into fine powder, etc. And her response is, well, are they there or not?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way to get people fighting about the exact modeling or calculating you'd want to do. Well, this same principle applies here when it comes to Erin. Okay, Erin, as a hurricane of such immense breadth, had a lot of electromagnetic energy, but let's not play into the hands of a Greg Jenkins who made this stupid claim that it would take more than five times the world's energy, whatever that is.
ridiculous, I agree.
To destroy these twin towers. This whole business about not having, you know, a big enough power cord is another bogus. As an economist, I can understand it best, and that is, it depends on the technology or the method by which you transform inputs into outputs. If you have a real powerful technology, you know, modest amount can transform that, and that's presumably what directed energy or free energy is all about. So you can get a tremendous amount of power off very little in the way of input. So it's kind of a false hunt to look for this Erin as a huge power source. I don't think they need a huge power source to fire up these directed energy weapons.
Hmm.
So I'm not foreclosing that, and I don't know that Dr. Wood is either. But, you know, she, you and her got off on another, maybe it's another wrong foot there, with the Hutchison effect.
Uh-huh.
You know, this whole anti-gravity work, unconventional physics, which here again, I'm not a physical scientist, nor do I pretend to be, even if I stay at the Holiday Inn Express. You know, all that stuff I say is I'm pretty well convinced it's for real. But
I don't like to dismiss things out of hand because people have the wrong credentials.
I don't either, Morgan, but may I say, you know, electromagnetism is one of the most complicated fields in the world of science, and I had a friend who's a, have a good friend who's done a lot of research with me on both JFK and on 9/11 who has a PhD in electromagnetism. So when Hutchison entered the scheme of things, you know, I consulted him. This is John Costella from Australia. And John told me that there was widespread skepticism about Hutchison's contributions, his alleged discoveries, and so forth. Now, that didn't preclude me from having him on my show. But it did mean when he came on the show, I wanted to ask him just some questions about his background, because it seems to me that, you know, one is just extraordinarily unlikely to happen on any significant discovery in the area of electromagnetism by chance, that it's going to require a lot of preparation, background, training, education.
I don't agree. I mean, it's just, look at Nikola Tesla was a genius, and I'm not saying Hutchison's on the same level of inventiveness and productivity, but, now we've entered this era, in, especially in the latter half of the 20th century and 21st, where credentials just play too much of a role, Jim, and I'm more of an open market, free market guy.
Morgan, listen.
Too many good things come from outside the academy.
Well, remember, I taught logic and critical thinking for 35 years, and I understand it's a fallacy to judge. It's like judging a book by its cover. You know, someone who has a brilliant idea, whether they have the background or not. It's the quality of their argument, the truth of their hypothesis, and all that. So it wasn't that I was going to, you know, prejudge the question. I was just interested in his background and training, and immediately he was elusive and wouldn't answer my questions. And, you know, it wasn't that I was trying to nail the guy. I was just interested in finding out who he was. But you're absolutely right that Judy took offense to this and started,
Hey, if we go to content, you know, Dr. Wood's article is, maybe it's a small encyclopedia. It's called Anomalies of the WTC and the Hutchison Effect. So, for example, you know, you get these peculiar bends of massive steel beams, you know, into horseshoe shapes.
Yeah.
Something extraordinary happened here. And then you've got all these upside-down vehicles. You know, what did that? Some kind of a levitation thing happened here. And, you know, it wasn't that we had any kind of huge seismic Richter equivalent. We didn't.
Uh-huh.
You know? So this was an extraordinary display of anomalous physical effects. And to just avert our eyes and talk about, John Hutchison is a quirky character, that doesn't get us very far.
But I wasn't averting my eyes at all. In fact, I was inviting attention to it. I mean, I probably spent more time going through Judy's website with Judy than anyone else has ever in the history of the movement. I probably did more to support and promote her work than anyone else in the history of the movement. I gave her a platform. I still support her, though I'm absolutely dumbfounded, you know, that she seems to have abandoned me, and even if what I'm being told is correct, undermine my opportunities to speak to different 9/11 groups, which I find highly objectionable.
Well, Jim, you know, it reminds me of what Friedrich Hayek, the Nobel Prize laureate in economic science in 1974, said about being in the middle of the road.
Yeah.
That's where you get run over. So...
Who's in the middle of the road in all this, Morgan? Neither you nor I, I'm afraid, is out there in the middle of the road. But we are targets. Right. We are primary targets.
Hey, Jim, you're not as toxic as Morgan because I remember telling you here, 6 months ago when we did an interview that I hadn't received any interview lecture visit requests.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a shame, Morgan, because, I mean, I think you're a fascinating guy, and I love to hear you speak, as I did in the conference, you know, the Madison Conference.
Right, right, right. And, hey, you know, I thought that was a very good event overall. But apparently it's the last one we're going to have for some time.
God makes me wonder.
I wanted to speak to this whole issue about infighting and conflict. Not only did the perps use these extraordinary means to put one over on the world and the American people, but it's been followed up then by these nearly 8 years by the usual kind of goodwill confusion, you know, the human circus where people are going to disagree and they have different personalities, different data banks they're relying on or not relying on and so on, trying to sort things out. And that, if it's all done in goodwill, that'll settle out and that conflict process, we're pretty confident, is the only way to get to the truth ultimately. But, of course, another aspect is that we've got conscious shills or agents here to help stir the pot and keep this thing boxed up. Hey, so far so good. I'd feel pretty comfortable if I were the perps. I'd still be very nervous that this whole thing could break out in the open.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, so you know, how much of it is stupidity and the normal conflict among researchers and propagandists and educators, and how much is that is political blindness, and how much is deliberate? Well, hey, you know, I can. The most frustrating part of this may be the corporate media, which really are just a disguised outlet for the powers that be. I know that's we'll call it an extreme statement, but, you know, the government has the most preposterous conspiracy theory, and even modest scratching on the Internet will show that it's false or totally ridiculous. You know, like I found Tsukami's passport on a sidewalk 2 blocks from the Flight 11 crash into the North Tower.
You don't find that reasonable, Morgan? You don't find that reasonable?
Yeah. Or we find this evidence trail, you know, a rented car with a Koran and my last, on and on. Just stupid stuff. And, you know, the corporate media, I guess my emblematic statement is, where is ABC News with a 3-hour special on 9/11? Well, they've never done one, have they? And I think there's too many savvy people out there.
Where's Condoleezza Rice white paper she was going to give the Taliban in Afghanistan? They said they'd turn over Osama bin Laden.
Right.
She produced evidence that he'd been involved, and she said, oh, yes, absolutely.
Right, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Colin Powell, who's still treated like a hero, you know, sacred ground at, where he walked, it's absolute bull. He promised Tim Russert on Meet the Press, oh, yeah, we're going to put this out to prove up the government case.
I still believe that Colin was just being played for a sap like the rest of us, though he should have known.
He's not that
stupid. He should have known better.
He's a savvy self-promoter. I don't see anything good about him except I remember when I think it was 94 or whenever his autobiography came out, and I saw him at a book signing and dealing with the public, and I told my wife then, I said, I just saw our next president.
Yeah.
You know, this is, and hey, yeah, he's charismatic, he's talented, et cetera, but man, after this, you know, beginning with that, well, the whole cover-up of 9/11, and he knows better. It's the same frustration I have with Ron Paul, you know, to be at the table.
Yeah.
Here's an example. Who was it? Justin Raimondo on antiwar.com was remarking in an op-ed this morning that Jon Stewart at Comedy Central, I forget, what do they call his show here?
The Daily Show. The Daily Show.
The Daily Show.
Yeah.
Yeah, he apparently took out after Harry Truman. And, you know, I blamed him for atomizing two cities in Japan.
John Stewart was attacking HST for using the atom bomb?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think that was the gist of it. Anyway, Harry, you know, the doughty battler, blah, 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 wasn't a hero. Well, a night or two later, he had to eat crow. In other words, this is one of the things where, hey, he went beyond the 40-yard line, you know, into enemy territory.
Yeah.
So, you know, the whole thing, I'm just pulling that as an example I was reading about this morning, where you can't, much less to go into the questioning 9/11 and exposing the whole lie, you know. So it's just the corporate media are absolutely worthless, and all these newspapers can go under, and I'll just applaud, you know. That's a problem they never mention in the declining newspaper industry. They're a bunch of liars, basically. You know, except that
they're covering it. Well, I know, Mark, and if they were only going after all the stories that are lying all around the place, I mean, then, you know, it would be something worth reading.
It would be worth supporting.
Worth buying a paper.
Yeah. How can they, you know, be the fourth estate, or you know, exposing wrongdoing in high places and all that? That's so yesterday.
I think there may be more investigative journalism going on at Op-Ed News than at the New York Times.
Oh yeah,
that's amazing.
Because at least there's some.
I put out a piece called "Has Cheney Been Murdering Americans?" and I talked about Paul Wellstone, Pat Tillman, and Beverly Eckert, and the suspicious circumstances involved in those cases. And it was hugely popular, Morgan. I mean, it ran five pages online, and it was, you know, like the top piece for over a week, and it keeps getting revived. I've been real happy about that.
Very good, yeah. Well, that's the one saving factor is the internet, and we'll see how long we can keep that free of their controls.
Oh, by the way, Killtown sent me a note saying he wanted me to say hi to you for him, and I think he's appreciative of all your good work.
Well, hello, Killtown. Hey, it's interesting. Apparently, he and Jeff Hill of PumpItOut.com have the two most active, truth-oriented, good stuff forums.
Yeah, well, I've had Killtown on many times, and I'm having Jeff on next Friday, a week from Friday, actually. He'll be my guest, so I'm looking forward to that.
One of the things I can't really explain, but there seems to be a fact, is how no planers, which are a very stout, sharp group. Hey, maybe we can't all fit on a tennis court, but there are dozens of sharp people who are no-planers, seem to be anti-Judy Wood or anti-molecular dissociation as the deciding factor in disappearing the World Trade Center. I don't know what's going on there, but there's some strange things where people, it almost looks like they get no plane credentials, and then they can diss the molecular dissociation explanation for all the evidence at the WTC.
Well, I don't know how you can explain it without molecular dissociation. I mean, as you observe, these 500,000-ton buildings are being destroyed in about 10 seconds apiece. If they were collapsing, they'd be collapsing through their point of greatest resistance. Below the 96th in the north and the 80th tower in the south, you have nothing but stone cold steel. You got those 47 core columns, all the support columns. I mean, it's preposterous.
It is.
To imagine that they could have collapsed in any scenario, I mean, it's just ridiculous.
It is. It's a complete fallacy to talk about a collapse. I've got to, that reminds me, I've got to get something right off my shelf, just a second.
Sure. And I want
to... You'll recall the much ballyhooed refereed article that Stephen Jones was going to put out early.
Yes.
And it ended up in some kind of a strange swap with that annual journal. and appeared in the Griffin and Scott edited volume called 9/11 and American Empire.
The paper that got swapped, Morgan, was mine. Griffin and Scott were going to use my paper on thinking about conspiracy theories as the first chapter of that book. But when it turned out that that other series had a Marxist orientation, they thought it was going to be better for Steve in relation to BYU that it not appear in that journal, and they asked me if I'd be willing to swap, and I said I would. Later, I decided it was really better for me to use it in my own collection on the 9/11 conspiracy, but that was the paper that was swapped.
How about that? I can't remember his name right now, but he is a Marxist economist, and he was actually at the University of Wisconsin, got his PhD a couple years before I did. It was interesting. I asked him one occasion where I was filling in for you as the host.
Yeah.
His last name is Paul Z. At any rate, I asked him to come on the show, and he wouldn't do it to discuss 9/11 and that volume that he had edited.
Why not?
Well, he wouldn't say. At first he said he had too much on his plate, and I said, well, we can put it back when the plate is less full.
Yeah.
That wasn't the real reason. Now, I think he knew that we would have some disagreements and... but hey, I would be civil about it. And
Paul Zaremka,
that's it. Yeah. But hey, the Stephen E. Jones article. Listen to this. It almost points toward molecular dissociation and directed energy, where the Stephen E. Jones paper, he says in the Griffin Scott volume, we observed that approximately 30 upper floors began to rotate as a block.
Yeah.
To the south and east. That's what you were talking about, at least in part. That was the South Tower. They began to topple over, Professor Jones continues, as favored by the law of increasing entropy. The torque due to gravity on this block was enormous, as was its angular momentum. But then, and this I am still puzzling over...
And those are his words. Those are his words.
These are Stephen E. Jones' words.
Right.
In this first, path-breaking article that we all were waiting for, continuing on with the quote, he said, this block turned mostly to powder in midair, ! How can we understand this strange behavior, Professor Jones goes on, without explosives? Explosives?
Right.
And then people are still trying to pursue the nuclear explanation. And where's the heat, for example?
Morgan, I've quoted that same passage on the air before because it's so significant in relation to Steve's own work, since it doesn't seem to be any way that thermite or thermate can account for it.
He admits that you've got it, it turned. And, one of my favorite photos of 9/11, favorite has this kind of crabbed term here, but it is a favorite in that it shows we in Wisconsin would have called a bubbler. The bubbler is a water fountain. Well, it's a bubbler of dust.
It's
just fine dust.
Hey, let me read you two passages and see if you can tell me where these came from. Hoffman further notes a number of features of the Twin Towers' collapse which suggests that they may have been, quote, demolished through some entirely different process, perhaps involving some form of directed energy weapon in addition to explosives. For a possible explanation of what kind of energy source could have been at work, we must turn our attention to the realm of new physical principles and thus to the class of directed energy weapons, which are probably most familiar to the general public in connection with President Reagan's so-called Star Wars speech of March 23, 1983. That is found on page 244 of what book?
I quit. I give up.
9/11 synthetic terror. This is in Webster Tarpley's
book. Oh, that's right.
And get this. Yes. Let me read you another passage. This is from page 270. According to Longman, there was a military aircraft, a Lockheed Hercules C-130 transport plane, about 17 miles away. This is in relation to Flight 93. Such a plane could easily have carried a powerful airborne chemical laser, and this type of directed energy weapon based on new physical principles might have accounted for the physical effects actually observed on the scene. That's also from synthetic terror made in the USA. So why should Judy be lambasted for offering hypotheses that have also come from Jim Hoffman and Webster Tarpley and this guy Longman? I mean, you know, it's ridiculous that she should have been so savaged.
Yes, well, it does tell you about the official 9/11 truth movement, the orthodoxy, right? And, yeah, it is. Even Webster Tarpley, I saw him on a tape here a year or two ago where he was responding to a question about Dr. Wood's work, and he said, in effect, that he was very open toward research in all venues, but it shouldn't be a part of the public discourse somehow. I can't remember how exactly he artfully put it. But the point is, you know, you can have kind of unrestrained truth-seeking over here, but let's not get it out to the public lest we be discredited or whatever, which I cannot stand that argument. The separation where certainly the person in the street can't be troubled with the real truth, you know, and yet more often than not, you're going to get greater receptivity than you'd have among the elite, you know, the glitterati, you know. It's
unbelievable, isn't it, Morgan? Either we want the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, or we don't. And it seems to me too many 9/11 truth seekers are willing to compromise.
People can deal with the truth. And when you get all this resistance, that's just affirmation that you are highly likely to be on the right track. Otherwise, it wouldn't be much of why bother, right? If somebody's so incompetent, you know, why do you need to destroy somebody's work? It'll just be destroyed pretty much on its own, unless it's very important and probably on the... So, you know, it's almost a two hands clapping.
One hand clapping, Morgan.
Yeah.
We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. We'll be right back. Morgan, I want to invite your attention to an exchange I had with Keith Dudney. It actually began quite a long time ago, and then he resurrected it out of nowhere, where it was based on an article. I was asking him to respond to five of the most important arguments for video fakery, which I published in Op-Ed News under the title "A New Proof of Video Fakery on 9/11," and I was talking about the consensus from all the authoritative military and FAA sources that the plane was traveling around 560 miles an hour at that low altitude, which, as you and I well know, is a physical impossibility. The way in which the plane had just melted into the building, another physical impossibility. The fact that this was in violation of Newton's laws of physics, which is obviously another impossibility. The fact that you could count the number of frames it took for the plane to pass through its own length in air, and it was the same number of frames it took to pass through its own length into the building, so that there was no deceleration whatsoever, and it passed through the one as effortlessly through steel and concrete as effortlessly as it did through air. And I tried to engage him in these issues, but he was extremely, evasive, and he kept referring to Eric Salter's piece claiming that there had been some deceleration. And Rick Ryder, of course, had actually addressed that issue already, and indeed I think even on your website, nomoregames.net, pointing out how Salter had committed a sleight of hand.
Yes.
Deliberately or not, that he used two different frames of reference to calculate the deceleration, and that his claim really didn't sustain critical scrutiny. At that point, Key became silent. And then months later, he posted a short piece that I'm going to read you right now that resurrected the issue. "Dear friends and colleagues, I must admit to having been a little puzzled about why the planes went through the perimeter column so easily. I realized they should go through, as the strength of the columns was all directed vertically, not horizontally, making their penetration a certainty. The video to be found here," and he gave a link, "explains very clearly why we saw exactly what we saw on the crash videos. The incoming aircraft had only had to shear a few bolts at the box column end plates. I really can't imagine how a no-planer can respond rationally to this, except perhaps to claim that all pictures of perimeter columns showing bolts at their end plates are fake. But that's not exactly a rational response, is it? Time to move on. All the best. Key. Well, you know, I talked with a structural engineer about this, Charles Pegolo, who'd actually done a lot of work with steel and fire and all that. He pointed out to me how those bolt plates, yes, they were those plates supporting in the perimeter columns were bolted, but they were also welded to the trusses, and that the trusses in turn were welded to the core columns. And of course, when you see the plane, allegedly 175, entering the South Tower, Morgan, it's on an angle, so it's cutting through a couple of floors. And the point I made in response to Key's claim was that on those trusses was 4 inches of poured concrete that represented an area in volume, so that plane should have been completely destroyed by its impact with an acre of 4-inch thick concrete. Now, Key never came back and said anything more about it, but others tried to, you know, resurrect or provide some kind of defense, which surprised me enormously, including some who suggested that the belief in no planes, and here, of course, I was arguing for video fakery, but once you recognize video fakery, it doesn't take very long to figure out why did they have to have video fakery if there were real planes. I've been assailed by no less a friend than Kevin Barrett for having been a Johnny, somehow jumped on the bandwagon here when you know well it took me 2 years, Morgan, and you're trying to, you know, butt my head against the wall here of the principles of physics to come around and recognize that what we were seeing in these videos was a fantasy. But yet Kevin would take me to task for, you know, sort of having jumped on this bandwagon when I took it very, very cautiously, very gradually. I probably had 15 different guests on, including you and Ace Baker and Killtown and the Web Fairy and others, John Lear, Joe Keith, and others still, you know, before I became convinced that it wasn't possible. What we were seeing on those videos was a pure impossibility.
Yeah, I wouldn't say you were first to come up with
no planes. No! It took me years to come around to even take it seriously. In fact, it was only when I realized you could separate logically video fakery from no planes, because you could have had video fakery and planes if there were features of the planes or their mode of interaction with a building that needed to be concealed. But, you know, Killtown has offered many arguments. I'm sure you have others still. So have others yet. And Ace Baker, too, has championed the position that the planes cannot have been involved here. But while I'm inclined in that direction for multiple reasons, I was dumbfounded as this new thread that Key had initiated with this clearly, totally flawed argument. I mean, just...
Well, yeah, this is pure sophistry.
Well, just a mistake.
He knows better.
Yeah, and so I was being accused here by others. I'm forgetting who authored the particular response that said that belief in no planes was an article of religious faith. But I went to point out that there were at least 10 data points that substantiated the belief in no planes, and that religious beliefs ordinarily aren't substantiated by 10 data points. Let me review them with you, Morgan, and see if you think, as I do, that these are important considerations in weighing planes or no planes. Here's the first. Key Dudney, isn't that interesting, has shown that cell phone calls would have been impossible, which means that those we have heard about are fabrications, some of which must have been created using sophisticated voice morphing technology at some considerable effort. Would you not agree that that's an important consideration in support of no planes?
Yeah, that's one of a couple hundred, but go on.
I know, I got a 10 here.
Yeah.
Elias Davidson has shown that the government has no proof that Islamic hijackers were aboard any of these planes. Where such evidence has been provided, the list from Anna's suitcase, the miraculous passport, and all of that is transparently fabricated. You know, isn't it amazing how they claim they have this list of the hijackers? This is how the FBI knew the day of 9/11, the names of these 19 hijackers, because Mohammed Atta had left a list in his suitcase?
But none of the passenger manifests had any Arab names.
I know.
None of the accused hijackers. And then, of course, within 2 weeks of the event, mainstream media went out and interviewed over 10 of the accused. In other words, these were stolen identities. And Robert Mueller, the head of the FBI, eventually, he basically intimidated them, shut all that down. And they went with the original 19 pictures of photos.
Well, it's ridiculous.
Complete fraud.
Yeah, and they're caught. They're impaled on the horns of the following dilemma: if they admit the list is wrong, then it can't possibly have come from Mohammed Atta's suitcase, as they claim, because he couldn't. If it was his list, he couldn't possibly have any of the names wrong. But it's absurd to think that somebody who's conspiring to perform an atrocity of major proportions would make a list of their collaborators. I mean, what a stupid thing to do. It's like the Brinks The Brinks robbers, they made a list of all their associates and put it in their suitcase before they robbed the armored car.
You know, American Airlines Flight 11 that allegedly went into the North Tower, it isn't in the database, okay? And so it never officially went off. But four of the five named hijackers were interviewed by corporate media after 9/11. And two of five, allegedly on Flight 175 in the South Tower, were interviewed by corporate media.
Isn't it unbelievable? So here's my third data point.
Okay.
John Lear, one of our nation's most distinguished pilots, has observed that before a commercial carrier can pull away from a terminal, the pilot must submit an envelope, including his flight plan, passenger manifest, and checklist for fuel, load, operation of electronics, and all that. Yet not one of the envelopes for any of these planes has ever been produced.
Sure. Well, that goes, the most cited item along that line was the first thing you do in an aircraft crash investigation is match up parts and the numbers, which are unique
this
to
is,
every aircraft.
This is my point number four. Club. You're right.
To identify for sure what plane it was. Well, they've never given us a single number.
No, you're absolutely right. This is my point, my fourth data point. George Nelson, a former U.S. Air Force air crash investigator, has observed that although each of these planes had hundreds and hundreds of uniquely identifiable safety-related component parts, the government has yet to produce even one from any of the four alleged plane crash sites. That's fairly stunning.
Right. And, of course, that also comports with the fact that we have the four cleanest airplane crash sites in history. Right?
The cleanest.
All within
it's
a little more than an hour of each other. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Here's a
Boeing has over 3 million parts. In fact, John Lear says it's 8 million, but the 767 official Boeing website number was, hey, you can count parts different ways.
Maybe a bolt with a nut
and a washer.
Yeah, might be one part.
Yeah.
Here's a fifth data point contradicting the claim that belief in no planes is an article of religious faith. Joe Keith, John Lear, and various aeronautical engineers, even persons at Boeing, have explained that no Boeing 767 or 757 could fly as fast at the altitudes involved, 700 to 1,000 feet in New York, skimming the ground at the Pentagon, as the videos show or as the government has claimed.
Yep, impossible speed. You know, we thrashed that out over a year, and we've got them. We've got them cornered.
I think that's exactly right.
Now, they keep on flailing, but we've got them.
Here's a sixth data point. Multiple pilots, including some from Pilots for 9/11 Truth, have said how difficult it would be to hit one of those towers at 500-plus miles an hour, where one group tried it with their flight simulator shortly after these events and found they were unable to do it after multiple tries, at best one time in five. I think, in fact, on the average, Morgan, it was much worse than that. Like, they tried among them, five of them, about 20 times or more, and only one was able to do it once.
Nobody could do it on the first.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
And, John Lear tried to rent a simulator for 767, this range of Boeing aircraft, and they wouldn't. And it seemed like part of the reason, if not the only reason, was political. Jim, if you were flying at 550 miles an hour, you would cover you would cover over two blocks every second. And, the South Tower event
supposedly
had this last second turn left, and they're only 23 feet off center. okay? And this is a novice pilot. give me a break. Yeah. It's just one whopper piled on top of another.
I know, like the Hani Hanjour, whose flight instructor said he couldn't fly at all executing that magnificent maneuver at the Pentagon.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Here's number seven. Video experts, including Ace Baker and Killtown, have explained how easy it would be to create fake videos and even have them played in very close to real time with a 17-second delay or even in real time using compositing by imposing a layer of the plane over images of the buildings themselves.
Yeah, when people challenge that, I mean, what are you talking about, folks? You know, it's just all the technological stuff we've got.
Maybe they think those first down yard lines on TV when we watch football games are real, Morgan, and they just sort of,
bend down.
And then they take them back up, between plays and all that. I mean, it's ridiculous.
It really shows people who have this predetermined result, they'll say anything to defend their position, no matter how absurd it is.
Yeah, I know it. Here's point number eight. 175 footage, the flight 175 footage, shows a plane traveling faster than aerodynamically possible, entering the buildings with no loss in velocity, passing through steel and concrete as effortlessly as it passes through air, with no debris or damage to the plane and passengers, no luggage, no seats, no bodies. This, of course, is the part and parcel of it just blending into the building. It's ridiculous.
Neat, yeah. Well, this goes back to Key Dudney and his declamation that it's all over because it should go because of the vertical strength of the columns. Hey, imagine that there weren't any vertical columns on the walls. There were only the lateral edges of six floors. Which, each one of those corrugated steel pans that they use is 7 tons. It's 20 by 60 feet. Then it is 4 inches of reinforced concrete, albeit lightweight, 60% of the normal ground stuff they use. And then you've got these spandrel belts that whose thickness varied, but call it an inch. Those are really substantial pieces. Those spandrel belts are about 4 feet high. There's so much. If you do the calculations like I've done, it's pretty simple. The weight, the mass of this steel concrete structure is 100 times that of the plane, okay? And it's one is the bug and one is the windshield.
It's ridiculous,
and when
Morgan.
These meet steel and concrete versus this aluminum plane, it is absolutely laughable, Jim, to have a Key Dudney tell me, well, of course it'll slice right through this building. To me, that shows he's an example of what the V.I. Lenin quote is, right? We're going to control the opposition? By leading it.
Well, it's ridiculous, and that I should give him such powerful reputations, and he's still not willing to come around and admit that he's wrong. I mean, that's worse than being wrong.
People don't, this is such sophistry. One of those columns, it's built primarily for vertical strength, but it's got a lot of horizontal strength. Come on, even at a quarter inch, that thing is 14 inches square. That thing is hell strong. I can remember I brought my little hitch, that you insert into a receiver to pull a trailer.
Right.
That thing is only 3/16 inch thickness. That thing is stout, way stout. I could take that.
Are you suggesting?
I could completely make a plane unflyable in 15 minutes. Actually, it wouldn't even take me that, but let's say it's 15 minutes. How are you going to damage the World Trade Center tower?
You can't
do a thing with it. You can break a couple windows.
Are you suggesting to me, Morgan Reynolds, that one of these steel plates is more substantial than a little bird?
Right. As we know, birds can bring down the planes, yeah.
Birds make huge holes in these. I mean, it's ridiculous. This whole thing is completely ridiculous. Here is my point number nine. Jack White has discovered Fox footage that shows FBI agents offloading something heavy at church in Murray Street shortly before an engine, alleged to be from the impact, was found, where the sidewalk is not damaged. It's sitting under a canopy, and it was from a 737, not a 767. I mean...
Well, yeah, that apparently... Now, this is kind of almost 99% sure, but John Lear says that dinky thing is not from a 767. It's probably a...
You mean...
And it seems to be a GE Smecma, the French partner. And that would have had to been from the 175 flight. You know, supposedly it went through and then conveniently landed on its end point under a scaffolding. And they always like placing these things under scaffolding, it seems, in an impossible flight. But United uses Pratt & Whitney engines exclusively. So they apparently, you know, it's the wrong engine every which way.
Yes. Well, it's just ridiculous. Now, of course, the tenth point I was making was the fact that those trusses were laden with concrete, so here you have the plane, you know, with no deceleration whatsoever, flying through an acre of 4-inch thick concrete without falling apart and having pieces...
And it's on a steel pan. You know,
it's ridiculous. That's right. It's on a steel pan.
And, you know, there's so many things wrong. If you look at my 54-page PDF on my NoMoreGames.net, and the second plane, the South Tower 175, hit at an angle, and it should have thrown that tail off, which can snap off under that kind of force, and it would have run into the core within 30 feet. Versus the North Tower, it would have taken 60 feet of penetration before it encountered the core. Well, you know, whatever's left of that plane, 30 feet? I mean, this thing is, what is it, 150?
Yeah, it's 155 feet long, maybe.
It would have had over 120 feet of the plane still sticking out when it knows
that's a
whatever's
nice
left
point,
of it.
Morgan. That's a really wonderful
the
point.
The core is 47 across brace columns with 5-inch concrete, like on the stairways.
Yeah.
You know? On and on. This thing is a 500,000 tons.
Yeah.
And your lousy plane is about 120 tons, depending on what's aboard. It weighs, a dry weight is like 80 tons. This is just a mismatch. Colossal.
Yeah, it's embarrassing, isn't it? I mean, you know, how can anyone... It doesn't require more than 10th grade physics to understand that this is an impossible scenario, and therefore videos that are presenting it can't be authentic.
Or here, you know, this is bringing back all these facts that come to mind. If you go on an airliner, jet airliner, and look out, sit near the over the wing, okay? In other words, get one of those up front type seats. Look out there, and you will see no step. No step, or do not walk beyond this line.
Yeah, that's right.
Those wings, in other words, a 200-pound man can damage those wings. And here we are shown footage that not an aileron, a flap, a panel, nothing comes off this plane. So, you know, what are you going to do but put the truth out there and hope that it's widely embraced, you know?
Morgan, it's embarrassing because, you know, there were a lot of good people on this list, and yet they really seem to have swallowed hook, line, and sinker this completely fabricated story, something that's actually impossible, a physical impossibility.
And look at what is where Purdue University supposedly finest engineering schools, and you know Professor Metzosian, and it's just the propaganda these people will put out, and I hope they're happy spending their money, you know, because it's blood money.
Do you think they're doing it because the government has given them so many contracts, or do you think they're
employed? This woman, who is the president of Purdue University, is on the board. She was appointed to the board of directors to the SAIC, which is one of Dr. Wood's principal targets, as it was mine, as a NIST contractor. These people are expert in directed energy weaponry.
Yes.
So here they are working on the cover-up for NIST. It's just a completely outrageous. This country is so corrupt.
It is damned interesting that the people who seem to be in the forefront are all persons who happen to be an expertise in the very area that Judy believes was most directly responsible for the destruction of the towers.
Yes, and I believe because the evidence is overwhelming. And, you know, another thing is these people, maybe hubris will catch them up eventually because they're very open. You got the Directed Energy Professional Society. There's no secret. The original article that we maybe mistakenly titled the Star Wars Beam Weapon or something to that effect, that there was Star Wars in it, meaning, hey, this is the most likely funding for how they arrived at this semi-secret weaponry.
Yeah.
Well, you know, to see this go down this way, and then, hey, that Bowman admission, Robert Bowman's admission, is pretty good. It's pretty good. It's a bit of truth because you look at what we're doing in foreign policy, and the whole thing is just so corrupt.
Oh, that's the truth, Morgan. Listen, we're going to take another break, and then we'll come back and continue our conversation. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. We've been discussing 9/11. The possibility of video fakery, planes, no planes, and a bunch of related issues. And, Morgan, I can't let the opportunity slip through my fingers to ask you about the current economic situation we confront in the nation, and whether you think Tim Geithner and Larry Summers are on the right track, or whether, as Paul Krugman suggests, they may be missing the boat.
Well, I don't agree with any of the parties above about what policy should be. Here's a long story short is the Federal Reserve created a boom, an artificial boom through artificial credit expansion. So Greenspan is the principal villain in the piece, but he had a lot of help because it's politically popular to have low interest rates and all the rest of that, okay? Well, every artificial boom leads to a bust, okay? Now, I don't want a boom, an artificial boom to begin with, because it would create a bust and the hardships therein. But what you should do when you have a bust is let the market heal. Let it reallocate resources with the attendant unemployment, because the structure of production needs to conform once again to what consumers really want, and instead of the entrepreneurs being misled by artificially low interest rates. Now, what we've had instead, of course, is massive artificial printing, inflation of money and credit. You know, it's just absolutely mind-boggling, Jim, what they've done. You know, the monetary base, or the Fed's basic assets, have gone from about, a year and a half ago, I think it was something like $750 billion, to $2.2 trillion. And this base, of course, once the banks start lending it out again, can lead to a multiple increase in the money supply. I'm very concerned. While we're in a deflation short run regarding prices, and especially asset prices, longer run, if this stuff really catches hold, you got a Zimbabwe thing. Yeah, I guess the short way to say that they're wrong in trying to reflate us back into a boom is, if this really worked, there wouldn't be any poor nations in the world. In other words, this is the Zimbabwe formula.
Not
applied quite as aggressively. Paul Krugman is we'll call it a left-wing economist whom I don't agree with about much. And he had a column here a couple of days ago where he was prattling on about how wage rates or labor compensation was, if anything, declining or stagnating. Well, this is part of the re-coordination process we need. Businesses basically need costs to fall, and basically you need a whole reallocation. It's the Austrian business cycle theory has got it right. There was a lot of malinvestment. I saw one of the websites I read regularly is by Mish, M-I-S-H. It's a conjunction of Mike Shedlock. And he showed some new homes that were not quite finished being just torn down because the lender didn't want to finish them out.
There were 19 new homes. I watched it take place too.
Yeah, it was in southern. It was in the high desert, I think, in Southern California. But in other words, they wouldn't be occupied for at least 5 years. So the cheapest thing for the lender to do was to tear them down. Well, this is a beautiful example. You could call it ugly, unfortunate, but it's malinvestment. It was a bad investment. Everybody would grant that. And what we've had is malinvestment on a colossal scale. So I'm not optimistic near term or even intermediate term. I think Japan is an object lesson of where we're going. And Japan was in better shape in 1990 than we are now. So, I've shorted the market for quite a while now. And right now I'm getting my brains beat in. Okay. But... hey, this thing can't be held together. You know, it's stiff and it's not even as good as duct tape.
Let me ask you this, Morgan. I was listening to a story on the radio this afternoon that Chrysler was going into bankruptcy, was selling off perfectly good plants that had been operating highly efficiently and laying off workers, and that they're going to take the money that they've been given by the government to build new plants in Mexico.
No, I'm sure they have. Well, I'm not sure, but lots of the legacy American automobile producers have had Mexican plants as well as, of course, Canadian. It's an international system, a global system we've got. So there's nothing terrible. Well, first of all, you know, you think that if this is true, it's an abuse of the taxpayers. Well, the abuse of the taxpayers is to bail out Chrysler at all. It shouldn't happen. By the way, I own a Dodge Ram truck, 2007.
You're not
that
anti-
I'm very happy with. That's a Chrysler product.
Yeah.
So it's not that I'm an anti-American automobile company. No, I'm not. But the point is, they need to make it on their own. If they can't make it, those resources need to go to better hands. In a bankruptcy Chapter 7. That's what the bankruptcy judge will do. Now, if this is an 11, you know, it's dirty because I'll bet the Treasury, the U.S. taxpayers, you and I and many other taxpayers, all of us, are debtors in possession and, you know, kind of. The whole thing is terrible. We should. Ford is not in much better shape, by the way, you know, because they went cash long in advance. It's very questionable whether they're going to make it either. So it's a crying shame. But you know who a principal problem child here is? The UAW. To see them, pick off the dead here and dying is pretty hard for me to take. They're not the first creditors. You know, part of the problem is we're a lawless country now, Jim. You know, you look at it's the automobile companies, it's all this intervention. Look what happened with this CEO, Lewis, for Bank of America, and, you know, the forced acquisition in the end of Merrill Lynch. Well, he's under oath with the Attorney General there, Cuomo. He is under oath. The CEO, he's no longer chairman, but he was told by Paulson and Bernanke, basically, you go through with this, or you're no longer the CEO and chairman of B of A, and we're going to get rid of the board. I mean, this is so extra legal. You know, this is pure politics. It's pure gun to the head. It's got, and where's the transparency? You know, the Treasury Secretary and the head of the Federal Reserve, you know, they mouth the platitudes. It's the tribute that vice plays to virtue. They talk as if we're going to have and look at tomorrow, we're going to get these stress test results. Yeah, they're going to certify that. That's another propaganda exercise. So, I'm very negative on all this intervention. We're a fascist economy by any, careful definition.
Let me ask you two aspects of our credit existence. One is, it wasn't until about 1980, I was living in Sarasota, and I had a good friend who was explaining to me how he had run a line of credit on his home so that he could get, you know, borrow against his home's equity, which, of course, was going up and up and up, and a lot of us thought, well, that was going to go on forever. That was a naive belief. But
right.
I wonder to what extent, you know, when Bush came in and started talking about the ownership society, he was actually encouraging mortgage companies and banks to give loans to people who may not be so very creditworthy for the political or ideological goal of giving everyone a slice of the pie, a home of their own, but it was inherently risky. People forget that it was a Bush strategy.
Well, it was, but, hey, you know, the Republican, I can't help but think back to George Wallace, the Alabama governor who ran for president and then took a bullet suspiciously. But you know what he said? There's not a dime's worth of difference between a D and an R. So that's what, you know, you got the right and left wings of the Monopoly Party, would be my cynical take on that. But that played into it.
Wasn't Nixon worried that Wallace might peel away just enough right-wing votes that cost him the election?
Yes, right.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't seen a good study on that, but the point is it's worth investigating. For at least wish somebody would do it. It's kind of like the attorney who did the Martin Luther King Jr. book, right?
William Pepper.
You know, I've got a couple of these books, the Franklin Scandal in Nebraska and that one, and I would advise people to be on high alert when you get a book that's written by a lawyer. They're really hard to read. They're worse than economists. But
Let me ask you this question, Morgan, because it's gotten a little bit of attention now, but probably not enough. I don't think it ever has, which is the interest rates that the credit card companies are able to charge, you know, I mean, they have gone into the usurious category for 10 or 15 years.
Well, buyer beware. You know, the real kind of the more fundamental problem, and I'm completely opposed to, you know, usury regulations and that here again, this is more government intervention.
You mean anti-usury?
Yeah, price fixing. Yeah. Maximum interest rate ceilings and, you know, no payday lenders and all that, even though, you can have abuses, but I'd rather have them resolved under the common law, even God forbid. But the main thing is the real fundamental problem here is credit, artificial credit. And guess what? This profits the banks and the powers that be, and it's completely corrupt. The only real saving, abstention from consumption, should find its way into investment. And you need we need a complete reform. We got to get rid of fractional reserve banking, where they promise you can withdraw all your money out of your checking account at any time. But if we all show up to do it, they don't have it, do they? You know, that's completely illicit, but it's done with the government conniving with the banking system. So that's corrupt. We need sound money. That's how we got prosperous. We once upon a time had precious metal money. And, you know, one of the most prosperous times, the most rapid real growth in wages was, take you back over a century, the 1880s. And a real condition for rapid, relatively rapid growth in the real standard of living is sound money. Hey, no inflation, no corrupt nonsense. Of course, you need technology. You need a benign property rights and relatively free enterprise and entrepreneurship. And then you can get there. But instead, you know, we've got we don't have those conditions. You know, the left worries about the lack of real gain in wages and kind of a stagnation for a couple decades. Well, guess what? We cut the last link between the greenback and gold in 1971. A Republican president,
Richard Nixon,
Bell Surprise, yeah. And ever since then,
what was he thinking, Morgan? What was Nixon thinking when he severed the link?
Well, you know, the French kind of forced our hand. Yeah, at that point, you could redeem dollars. Dollar-denominated accounts, foreign governments could, at $35 an ounce. So people, you know, the French came in and said, here's our $35 billion, give me the gold, okay? Well, he closed the gold window, and that was supposed to set us free, you know. And no, that's why, you know, Keynes called it the barber's relic. But it's a wonderful relic in that it ties the abusers down. And now it's just funny money. It's absolutely crazy. Well, you know, they're completely unconstrained.
My interpretation has been basically that the you know petrodollars have been the linkage. It's no longer gold, but it's black gold, in that as long as the United States currency was the currency of choice in relation to the buying and selling of oil, that it would maintain some kind of semblance of significance or value. But now that you have, petro-euros and other cartels that are willing to go absent the oil, it seems to me this is all badly shaken.
No, I agree with that point. That is, we've dominated the sheikdoms and the oil, the energy industry, and that's a very important point in terms of preserving the international value of the dollar. And I agree, it's kind of a precious material, a link that doesn't really replace gold and silver, but that still is a valid point. And, the dollar's shown surprising strength over the last 6-8 months. But part of that is this we'll call it the credit crunch, where people need dollars. That was part of the reason the inventories have gone down, is that businesses needed to get leaner and meaner to survive, and you need cash. You need cash, so you need to throttle back on your inventory. I went by a recreation vehicle dealer, and of course some of those dealers are going under, as well as the manufacturers, in hard times, and wow, I said, boy, his inventory is really slimmed down.
And doesn't it make matters worse when you cut back on supply because there's reduced demand, and you let your workers go, and so they have less resources to produce the demand that keeps everything going, so that we're putting ourselves in a worse and worse position for recovery?
Well, no, it is hard. It is hard. But if we'd allowed this thing to go down initially, we would be powered out of it by now. That's the problem with keeping the halt and wounded and unproductive allocations of resources, and keeping the same old people. Oh boy, we fired Rick Wagner, the CEO of GM. Woo-wee, The market, man, the market would have done a lot more than that. And instead, they're fighting the market. They're fighting reality. So you need to get the whole system, the structure of prices and wages and the resources. You need a different group by and large. Of course, not everybody's in deep water. But it's a shame, on the other hand, to see the prudent, being victimized in the same way. And, again, this can't work, all this government intervention. Japan's a good example of that. FDR was a good example of that. The New Deal never worked, and people say World War II worked. Well, hell, you put 12 million men in the army, then you had maximum wages. You had wage price controls. Guess what, jobs were easy to find, et cetera. So the peacetime New Deal never worked. We had 17% unemployment in 1938. It was hardly any improvement. So all this intervention is fighting the market. The market's trying to make the adjustment to reality and what the structure of consumer demand really is, not the fake structure that was assumed by, disguised, induced by this false credit expansion.
Would it be your opinion that it's a false conception to suppose that any institution or bank or entity is too big to fail? That's a mistake.
I would say that. Yes, I would say that. Even the federal government.
Uh-huh.
But, yes, although that, here again, that's kind of a superficial way to put it. Yeah, none of them are too big to fail. It would have given everybody the right signal. Get your house in order. Let people take a bath who got overextended. And let the people who aren't overextended carry on. And a lot of those people need to take over the positions of these failed institutions and failed. One of the most in-your-face aspects of this whole thing is Timothy Geithner. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a Rockefeller guy. This nexus of the Ivy League, the military intelligence complex, energy, and big banks. It's so obvious that Bernanke and Geithner, Paulson before him, are serving their masters.
News, politics, rumors, rants, and debates. It's the worldwide home of free speech radio. RevereRadioNetwork.com. Total free speech, even when it's ugly.
Their colleagues. It's not the American people. The American public intuits this. It'd be great to have some of these guys go belly up. And we have a legal system that knows how to handle bankruptcy, Jim. It's not like we need to intervene and go extra legal here. All we're doing is getting, you know, what got us into this jam was artificial expansion of credit. What are they using to cure the problem? Artificial expansion of credit. It makes no sense.
How can we work our way out of it, Morgan? Letting these companies fail.
Well,
I mean, obviously, we're
the basic thing policymakers ought to do. Number one, short run, is do nothing. Stop your interfering. Okay, let assets and everything else be priced in accord with reality, and then you will get once you bottom out, which is pretty quick. Then you can you've reestablished the foundation for sound economic growth. You know, the Reagan administration kind of got lucky in that we had that blowout at the end of the 70s, the stagflation era, and they kind of, in a way, let it Volcker restrict the growth of new money, although he only reduced it to 8%. But still, we had a kind of a back-to-back bath of recessions. And then the 80s, by most assessments, they were pretty good. We had growth because we kind of bottomed out and reestablished the foundations for solid economic growth. I remember when I went into the U.S. Department of Labor as a new Bush-Cheney appointee and Secretary Elaine Chao, and I said to her, around as well as others there at the U.S. Department of Labor, hey, we got this 9/11 event. We got a recession. Let it wash out. But Greenspan and company, they're the most important. But the fiscal component also was, oh, no, we got to rewrite. We don't think that way, is what she said, the Secretary of Labor. We don't think that way. I said, well, that's what we did with the Reagan thing. And by the time the election came around, you had real economic growth. You know, memories are short. Hey, and then you had a good second term regarding economic growth. I'm not a Reagan apologist, you know,
yeah.
Nicaragua, Iran, blah,
sure.
blah, blah. But the point is, take your recession early, and you're going to grow thereafter. That's the way to do it. Of course, we still never learn our lesson about artificially low interest rate, artificial expansion credit, fake non-savings, and da, da, da. And we just redo the whole thing again because the boom times, you know, the party itself feels so good. The hangover, you know, our problem this time is this is not an ordinary recession. This is going to be an L-shaped, long slog.
Do you think this poses major problems then for Obama and his desire to get a national health care policy, for example?
Once you start printing, how are you going to pay for it is the first question, of course. And we almost have it. We're almost there already in all but name. And we've got Hillary there on a Fulani tactic basis. We've got all these third-party payment mechanisms. So we're almost there already. But the problem, of course, when you got so much government intervention and third-party and quasi-governmental institutions, et cetera, is the inefficiency and unresponsiveness ultimately. So, hey, you know, Obama won, I'd say, fair and square. And he is very charismatic and very popular, but going down that road with more welfare and a war, he hasn't done anything regarding de-escalating the warfare complex. So that's just more intervention that I'm not fond of. You and I disagree about that, that's for sure.
Did you mean warfare or welfare? You mean the
support
for the war?
Both. They go together.
Yeah.
They go together. You know, the kind of the nationalist agenda of big government everywhere. It's a crying shame, you know. But everything changed in 1914. That was the big year for the end of open gains and hard money.
Creation of the Fed you're talking about?
Well, yeah, that was one element. I'm talking about the onset of World War I. But the Fed and abandoning hard money, et cetera, yeah, that's all part of the same syndrome where collectivism still dominates the political ideology.
Morgan, I can't thank you enough for coming on. It's always a pleasure, and I look forward to having you back again.
I appreciate it, Jim. We had a good time.
Terrific. Thank you so very much. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. I want to thank everyone out there for listening.